minutes, 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Welcome to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. My name is Grant Cameron. And today, as promised, I want to talk a little bit about the story of AFA the alien. And I also want to talk a little bit about the U.S. Navy, which is involved in the AFA story. And it's also heavily involved in the UFO story, which many people may not have realized. The Navy, at this point, is playing stupid. Or maybe they are just a shell for somebody above them when it comes to UFOs. Because they're putting out a story about UFOs, they have a task force. And when you start looking at it, there are a couple of things that don't make any sense. They're basically just talking about threat sightings, interactions that can be considered a threat, a potential threat. The whole story only starts at the Nimitz, and other people have picked this up as well. It's as if the UFO subject just started in 2004 when the Nimitz happened, with these incursions into the carrier group airspace. And the other thing that's changed that people just sort of look the other way, but I think is more significant than people think, is the change of the name to UAPs. Changing it from UFOs to UAPs, because that happened once before. In 1947-48, the term that was used was flying disc or flying saucer. In 1952, the U.S. Air Force changed the term to UFO. It was Ruppelt, who ran Blue Book, who changed the term. And it was clear at that point that the reason that the name was changed was to get people away from talking about flying discs and flying saucers, which implied that this was something extraterrestrial or off-planet or something that we don't have. But the word UFO could be anything. You could talk about weather balloons, swamp gas, whatever. And now we see they've changed the name to UAP, which indicates somebody is managing the story. These things are being done to move the story down a certain road in a certain direction. Now, I've asked some people about this, and one of the people that I try to get an impression on what's actually going on here, what's the motive behind this congressional investigation, which is being pushed basically by the Navy. And one of the people that I always try to get a comment from is Ron Pandolfi, who has been with the CIA since 1983, which would indicate he's not some low-level guy. He's always been rumored to be the guy who runs the weird desk, the guy who briefs the President of the United States on UFOs. And this is what I got back through Dan Smith, who sometimes talks to Ron and gets material from Ron and then puts it out into the UFO community, which makes it plausible deniability. So I asked Dan Smith about this whole thing, and he said, this is what Dan replied to me. However, the glass ceiling will have been broken. So he's admitting that, yes, this is going to change the whole UFO scenario when this report comes out. It's going to be tremendous pressure on the government to do something. The other thing Dan said is all the old rumors will be recirculated with some fresh eyes, which is something I'd never thought about. Because a lot of people are on an investigation profile that they only research what happens today. They really don't try to put it into a pattern of what happened in the past. They just go almost like the 24/7 news cycle. To go from story to story to story to story. And once you've done that story, forget about it and You wait for the next story to be leaked from whoever is trying to manage the story. You run with that story, and then you wait for the next story to leak. And the idea is that the answer to the UFO subject is always going to be in the next story. Forget about the old stories. And so what's going to happen here is some of the old stuff is going to be brought up, and the people who are just new into the thing, new into the phenomena, will start looking at it. And that includes all the major media that have never looked at it before, CNN, Fox, Politico, Washington Post, will all start looking at all these old stories and recirculating them and putting different impressions. The most significant thing that Dan gave me was something that makes no sense to me, but he said, Ron calls this release a calculated spoiler attack, keeping some control over the battle to come. I have no idea what that means, but that's what Ron says. Let me repeat it. Ron calls this release a calculated spoiler attack, keeping some control over the battle to come. And you got to remember that I've always said that he may be the guy who's actually running this whole circus, because he's pretty high level. Now, one of the things that I pointed out before that I'll point out again is that the Navy plays a much more significant role than I think people realize in the UFO phenomenon. People will ask, well, why would the Navy be involved? And one of the things I've always brought up is the fact that people forget that when the UFO phenomenon started big time in 1947, there was no Air Force. So everybody always assumes because these things are flying around in the air, it's the Air Force's job, but there was no Air Force. There was only the Navy before then and the Army. And the Navy is a well-known fact that the Navy had the vast majority of the research funding. And what happened in World War II is there's 200 inventions, and it was suddenly realized that you could put a lot of money into the military for research and development, and that stuff like nylon, synthetic rubber, jet engines, plastic explosives, bombs, nuclear energy, all these things were developed during World War II from funding that went into the military. So the thing was that after the war ended in 1945, all that funding kept going. They continued on with what was called the Research and Development Board, realizing that if you get these high-level scientists out of universities that don't work for 5 months a year and employ them in this, that you can create an awful lot of military technology, which then gets spun off into the public domain. And that has been, I maintain, the way that this stuff has really worked. That first the military gets the money, they get the leading edge research, and it funnels down into the public after that. Now, in 1946, 47, all the research funding was Navy. So when the UFO thing started and started up and the Air Force started in 1947, people would assume that the Air Force would come along and they would suddenly get all that funding from the Navy. Well, the Navy's not going to give up their funding. They're going to say, this is our game, get lost. So the Air Force would start their own little thing, but the Navy's not going to give up any power of the money and the power and the research capabilities that they have, that they've always had. Now, when I was working with the Canadians, and this AFA story goes to the Canadians, when I was working on what the Canadians were doing in the early 1950s, it was evident from the top secret memo that Wilbur Smith had been talking to somebody very high level in the United States. So I went to people around, it was called the Inner Circle. There was about six people who secretly worked from various agencies with Wilbur Smith, and they were working on gravity control experiments and pieces of metal that were coming from the U.S. Air Force for analysis and stuff like that. And I asked some of them, and I said, who was Smith dealing with? Because we were trying to figure out where did he get this top secret information. And Smith called it officials in the United States, and everybody always believed it was the Navy. And there were a couple of people that were named that Wilbur Smith was dealing with, high-level people. One of them was a guy by the name of Admiral Knowles. And Admiral Knowles lived in the Maine area, Elliott, Maine, and that's where the AFA story comes from. So he was dealing, and they named a couple of other people inside the Navy that Smith was dealing with. And we have to realize that there was a lot of other people that were also Navy. One of them was the first head of the weird desk at the CIA, was Arthur Lundahl. Arthur Lundahl ran the Navy Photographic Interpretation Center for the Navy, And then he analyzed in 1952 for the Robertson Panel Report. He's the guy that analyzed all the UFO photographs and videos for the Robertson Panel Report. And they liked the work he'd done, so they offered him a job at the CIA. When the U-2 started up in the 1950s, they were taking photographs, and the CIA needed a place to analyze all the U-2 photographs. So they started the National Photographic Interpretation Center, which was one of the most highly secret CIA buildings, which was in the slums of Washington, D.C., where nobody, the Russians, the last place they'd look for it. And all the poor people that were around there thought they were printing money there because there was such high security around this rundown building where they were doing this for the photographic interpretation. Now, later, the lab did analysis of the SR-71 photographs and then the spy photographs. So it was done at the National Photographic Interpretation Center, which was run by Arthur Lundahl, who was Navy. The whole UFO story was supposedly run by Vannevar Bush. That's what the Canadians were told. And Wilbur put it in his memo, said that the UFO program was being run by Vannevar Bush, a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush was Navy. We dealt with Dr. Eric Walker. Dr. Eric Walker had 14 honorary doctorate degrees. He was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis. Very close friends with Vannevar Bush and all the other MJ-12 people. Very high-level guy, 15 years as president of Penn State University. And he was the co-developer of the homing torpedo. He ran one of the big Navy labs, the underwater lab that did the submarine research at Penn State University. And he also ran a place in Italy where the subs would go into. So Eric Walker was a big Navy guy as well, and he knew exactly what was going on. Ron Pandolfi, if you listen to read the Dan Smith stuff over the year he's written, he kept referring to the fact that Pandolfi had talked about all the Navy flag officers being briefed. Now, that would just be something you wouldn't gloss over. But if you know this Navy connection, then you say, well, maybe this has some truth to it. Why is Pandolfi always claiming that the Navy officers are getting UFO briefings? That may be because the Navy has always run the UFO program. They've always been the people in behind. Now, much of this material I've got, the Canadian material, and this connection to the Navy and the connection to what was going on in the United States is in a book I have coming out called The Canadian UFO Story. And recently I found a whole nother file, and I'm not sure what we're going to do. On my podcast, I'm going to release a lot of audio tapes that were done in the 1950s where Wilbur Smith is talking, or they're talking about some very interesting stuff like the 1954 satellite story, if you don't know that story. But the other thing we're going to do is we're going to try to reproduce some of this material that was produced by U.S. Navy intelligence. So U.S. Navy intelligence was involved, and I'm going to mention that in a minute. So when you have the story now that the Navy is upset that they, you know, there's these incursions inside their airspace of their carrier groups and stuff like that, and the story goes back a lot farther than that. The Navy has always been sort of into this. And I actually went to get the Navy file, and they claimed they didn't have it. But through Dr. Eric Davis, I have gotten a file. He sent me 20 years ago a file, which I've just found this file. I had not really looked at it for many years. It's a massive file on stuff that Navy intelligence had done channeling this alien by the name of AFA. Now, another person, if you want to talk Navy, and this is another one of these controversial stories where you say, well, this is just a hoax, but then when you start looking at it, you realize that Bob Lazar, who was at Area 51, maintained up and down all the time that Navy was involved, that the Navy was running the lab that he had, and people would say, well, it's just part of a hoax, but why would he come up with this bizarre Navy thing that the Navy was running it? It's the same sort of thing. If you look at the Trump story, when Donald Trump gets briefed, he describes the fact that he was briefed by the Navy. The Navy came in, showed him these videos, and he said they're very interesting videos, but I don't believe in UFOs. So again, you come down to this idea that the Navy has a key role in this whole thing. One of the other stories that I had worked on, this gets to why I got this file from Dr. Eric Davis, was because the Eric Davis and Hal Puthoff were looking at the Canadian propulsion. Wilbur Smith had written a lot of stuff on how he believed flying saucers were working. He had been dictated this book by AFA called The New Science. And so Hal was always interested in looking at material that was coming from experiencer-type people to see if there was anything there that he could use to figure out what the technology was. And at one point, they were very interested in the whole Minerva Space story. The film that later became Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the fictionalized story is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I was contacted because I had been involved quite closely with Bob Emmenegger, who was the guy who actually had the Holloman Air Force Base in his possession, did a documentary called UFOs Past, Present, and Future in 1975, and then redid that again with some additions in 1979 called UFOs It Has Begun, which you can actually find on the internet. And that is part of the story that I'm going to tell in a minute. In there, there's a story about channeling this AFA alien. Now, when they started to look for it, one of the things I had heard, I don't know what they found. Hal was trying to find the Holloman Air Force Base film, where it was, who had it. I guess they wanted to see it or whatever, or confirm that it existed. And one of the things I heard that a senator from Connecticut, Christopher Dodd, had filed an FOIA. When this film was shown and talked about on the UFO Cover-Up Live, somebody had gotten upset, and Dodd actually filed an FOIA to obtain this Holloman Air Force Base film. And I believe what he was told, it was in a Navy sink. Now, what that is, I have no idea. But again, you have this thing coming up about the Navy. And now we've got the Navy again. All the sightings that are being talked about now are Navy. All the leaked videos are coming out of the Navy. It's as if the Air Force and the Space Command and Army don't exist. And so you've got a question, is there some importance to this Navy thing? Now, let's get to the AFA thing. This is how I found out about AFA. Now, AFA is an alien that was being channeled by a bunch of different people back in the 1950s. I first heard about the story. My father worked for the Department of Transport in Canada. That's the same department that inside the government that did the Project Magnet, which was the official Canadian government flying saucer program. My father's not involved in any of that. He was in inspections on runways and stuff like that. In the middle of the country, the program is being run out of Ottawa, which is on the east side of the country. But at one point, my father said, Ernie Epp wants to talk to you. And Ernie Epp was a radar tech guy who worked in my father's office, and he wants to talk to you, had a UFO sighting. So I went to talk to this Ernie Epp, and the sighting that he gave me was just a light in the sky type thing. And then he said to me, he says, you know, if you want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should find out what the Canadian government was doing back in the 1950s. I was involved, and it was really weird. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I work for this Wilbur Smith guy. And Wilbur Smith was one of the smartest engineers he'd ever met in his life. But he said he was totally crazy. And he said he had worked for Wilbur, and he'd worked in what was called the Flying Saucer Observatory that Wilbur had set up. And in there they had five different instruments to try to detect a UFO flying over the nation's capital. So Ernie was a junior engineer at the time, and he was changing tapes in the paper tapes that they were using. And he said Wilbur was the smartest engineer he'd ever met, but he was absolutely totally crazy. He had this alien he was talking to, and he was landing in the backyard and going, what are you talking about? And he said, yeah, and his name was AFA. And he said, we used to make jokes, and we used to bug Wilbur and say, yeah, AFA, have a half another pint, Wilbur. And they ridiculed him over this AFA thing. And that was the first time I heard about AFA. So what happened was, I had been looking for an answer to the UFO thing, and so I decided I'm going to Ottawa. Wilbur had died in 62. This is going into 77, I guess, already. And I went to talk to Wilbur Smith's wife about what was going on and what she knew and what had occurred in the 1950s and resolve all these questions about stuff that Ernie Epit told me. So I flew to Ottawa, rented a car, picked up Mrs. Smith at her house, and she said, we're going to Jim's house. And that was her oldest son. So as we were driving there, I remember she started to talk, and she was half of this, half of that, and it was like she was talking about the family pet. It was just so bizarre how she was just, it was like everyday thing. I'd never heard about this alien before. And so we got to James's house, and we had these discussion about the files, them trying to get the files and all this kind of stuff. And so I asked her questions about some of the things that the rumors said that had been out. And one of the big rumors was in 1967, Paul Hellyer had given a speech in St. Paul, Alberta, which was a centennial project. The town of St. Paul, Alberta had a centennial project. And what they had built was a UFO landing base. It was a tourist attraction thing. And so then Secretary of Defense, or Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer, gave this speech. And in the speech, 1967, July the 1st, he said, I just want to let you know, this isn't the first landing base. We actually built one in 1954 at Suffield, Alberta, for UFOs to land. Nothing ever landed, therefore UFOs don't exist. Something to that effect. And the thing was, Suffield was a top secret army base in Alberta where they had done nerve gas testing and all sorts of things, blowing up towns. And also, it was almost like Area 51, a restricted overflight area, a no-fly zone. And so I had always questioned, and I and another researcher had been actually after Paul Hellyer in the 1970s to try to get him to answer the question, well, how did the aliens know where to land? I mean, it's fine you open the base, but Canada's a big country, so how do they know where to go? I mean, you can say UFOs don't exist, but somebody had to have something in order to open that base. There must have been some sort of agreement or some sort of contact. So I went to Mrs. Smith, and I gave her an article from the front page of the Winnipeg Free Press, which was titled Top Secret Project Strikes Out. And I said to her, can you read this article, and can you tell me, was Wilbur Smith involved in this? And she read it, and she said, yeah, it was Wilbur. And the story she told me was that Wilbur Smith had been in contact with AFA, and he'd always wanted to have the contact. He wanted to fly over the Flying Saucer Observatory in Washington, and he had gone, according to Merle Smith, who was the wife, and she was secretary to the Speaker of the Senate, so she was no low-level person herself. She was just about to retire, was ready to talk, and said, yeah, that Wilbur had gone, and that they had been involved with the Prime Minister, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the military. And Wilbur had said, if you quit trying to shoot these things down, I'll get AFA to land. So there had been an agreement where they were going to land at Suffield, Alberta, and that's the whole story. That's how the alien knew where to land, because Wilbur was making this claim that he was going to get it to land there. And so everybody agreed they would allow it to land without interference, without trying to shoot down or anything. Then Wilbur, AFA wanted an agreement that once he took off, they would allow him to take off. And according to this, what Wilbur Smith's wife told me, that there had been an agreement from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and from the military, but they couldn't get a 100% guarantee from the cabinet, from the Prime Minister's cabinet, that they could get a clearance for this thing to take off again. So Wilbur said, okay, that's it. Nobody's landing. We're calling it off. That's what happened. The whole thing was arranged. Nothing ever landed because Wilbur called the whole thing off, the landing, but they had actually opened up the base, and this was what was going to happen. Now, there was a bunch of other incidents where AFA was involved. I asked a guy by the name of Art Bridge, A.W.L. Bridge, who was the metallurgist who worked for Wilbur Smith. He was a young guy who was a metallurgist with the Department of Defense in Canada, who was doing the metal research, and Wilbur's getting all these pieces, and his son has talked about these, and people from Ohio. Some of these tapes I'll actually play on my podcast. These people talking about Wilbur doing this analysis of material. And so Bridge told me, I asked him, I said, well, how many contacts did Wilbur have? Was he talking to AFA? Because there was this question about them landing in the backyard. Did he actually talk to AFA face-to-face? And he said, no, as far as he knew, there was only two contacts. And I never really clarified exactly what those two contacts were. But he stated that stuff would happen, like this automatic writing thing, which was very popular. Mrs. Smith was doing this as well later on after Wilbur died. The Ohio group told me that she'd come in one day and to their group, and she had actually sat in the middle of the room, sort of in the dark, with a yellow legal pad, and it completely filled the legal pad up, doing this automatic writing thing where she was getting answers. So this automatic writing thing, what was happening with Wilbur was, according to Bridge, was that Wilbur would wake up in the morning. He said this is sort of how this stuff would come. Wilbur would wake up in the morning and he'd say, oh, Alpha says this, Alpha says that, and he would have all this stuff written down on this pad that he would have written in the middle of the night when he was sleeping. And one of the examples they showed, and this is actually Wilbur actually in one of his lectures, I think you'll hear this on some of the audio tapes, where Wilbur actually talks about this, is they had this gravity control experiment that they had set up, and there was they had a guy from the Navy and a guy from the Air Force and Bridge from Defense, and all these people, they would all go Saturday mornings and they would work on this gravity control experiment in the garage. And it involved spinning this plate at a very high rev, 17,000-18,000 revs a second, with magnets epoxied onto this copper plate. And it was the whole idea of to get an electromagnetic field moving at very high speed, and the gravity would reduce. So anyway, they had this experiment, and Wilbur had gotten a message. No, that was how he got it. But then he said he would get those messages, and he would come in. And what happened was they were running the experiment on a Saturday morning, and the other person that was in communication with Alpha was described as a blind telex operator. So the phone rings, and it's the blind telex operator, and he says to Wilbur, I just got a message from Alpha, and he says, shield the experiment. So Wilbur comes walking into the garage and says, that's it, shut her down, we've got to shield the experiment. Alpha says, shield the experiment. So they build this wall, and this actually did happen because Wilbur actually talks about this. And I think Wilbur, and in either the written thing that he talks about, or in a verbal thing where I may have the actual lecture, where he said somebody would have been seriously injured. We were pulling ceramic magnets out of the wall. And what happened was they built a concrete wall around this thing with this plate that was spinning at these very high revs. And they turned on the experiment and the thing exploded and these magnets were flying. Everything was flying all over the place. And Wilbur said somebody would have been seriously injured if we hadn't got this alert. So these are sort of how the messages were coming. There was a bunch of people. There was an electrical engineer that I was told in the Ottawa group who was actually in contact with another alien that was involved. And his name was Tyla. And Tyla was a garbage collector. And in the 1950s, it was the same thing as now. You're hearing these messages about shut down nuclear weapons. Well, Wilbur was talking about this at great length, about the fact that they were being told that you've got to shut these nuclear weapons, that it affects the planet, it affects the universe, that you have the bomb going through and it was causing fields of reduced binding, and the planes were flying through these reduced bindings and they were crashing. This is what Wilbur Smith was saying, and that he was filing this for the Department of Transport, that these reduced binding things were being affected, caused by these nuclear tests and stuff like that. So he would get these different messages, and he also got an entire book, which is we may try to get permission from James to publish this book, but he published a book and had never finished the book. There was maybe the last chapter or two he didn't get done because he died, but he claimed that was directly being channeled to him. He was using a radio receiver and had described Alpha as, he called them the boys' top side. So there was Alpha, there was Tyler, there was Ponar, there was all these different beings. And they would get material. So Wilbur Smith had 37 different patents, according to his wife. Only one that he got to put through. And she said they were very upset when he got it through. They claimed that he was working on government time, therefore all the patents belonged to them, and he only managed to get money out of one of the patents. But he was getting all this material from AFA, and there was a bunch of people. So Wilbur, if you read his writings, stated that there was a bunch of people that where they were cross-indexing what the people were saying, and a lot of people were in contact with AFA. When I talked to the people in Canada, the people in the inner circle, They would never refer to the woman's name. They always referred to a psychic in the United States. Even James Smith would refer to the psychic. Her name was actually Frances Swan, and she lived in Elliott, Maine. And the interesting thing about it is she actually lived across the river from Betty Hill. So she's very, very close to Betty Hill. And the thing was that Frances Swan dealt with the blondes, or the 1950 type aliens. And she was sort of the last of the real big 1950 people who was pushing this thing. And then when Betty Hill came along and Nancy Tremaine came along, Nancy was actually first. Then suddenly the Greys came. Nancy had contact with the Greys, so did Betty Hill. And that transfers it over. And there's actually a meeting between Betty Hill and Frances Swan. Because what happened, according to what I was told, is that NICAP, the big group at the time, was really not that interested in Betty Hill's story about aliens abducting people off roads. This is total nonsense. I mean, aliens don't grab people off roads. That was, you got to remember, this completely new story. And so what happened is Admiral Knowles, the Navy guy, lived next door, very close to Frances Swan, said to Betty, well, I'll bring you to Frances Swan, and she'll explain to you what happened to you and calm you down or whatever. And according to what I was told is that when Betty Hill went over there, as soon as Frances Swan heard that she was dealing with Greys, she said those are the evil ones. She was very religious. There was the good guys and the bad guys, and she interpreted the Greys as being evil and basically did not want to help Betty Hill after that, saying that she was dealing with these evil Grey aliens. And then later on, well, I'll get to that later on, she teaches a Navy intelligence guy how to channel, and he also starts getting into trouble with what she interprets to be the Greys. Now, there, as I said, there was Ponar, and there was Alpha, and there was Tyla. And this gets into this whole idea of, is this actually aliens? I remember very specifically because Alpha claimed that he was from Uranus. Now, Uranus is like, whatever, 300 degrees below zero. And Uranus, like, nobody's living on Uranus. And I remember the Art Bridge telling me at one point, he said, look, let me make something perfectly clear. At no time did Wilbur or I ever believe Alpha was from Uranus. And he would also, Alpha would also say that he had a base on the moon. Now, this is the 1950s, before we knew that, you know, there's limited chance that anybody lived on Mars or Venus or all this kind of stuff, or the moon. And then what you see is after that, then the alien stories start to change, and the aliens start to say, they no longer say they're from Mars and Venus and the moon or Uranus or Pluto. There's even one that Preston Dennett talked about with somebody off on a Ouija board dealing with this one being who claimed that he was from Pluto. So once they had that, then they started changing the story to Alpha Centauri and Zeta Reticuli and the Pleiades and all these types of things. And then when we learned about multidimensional universes, then suddenly they started talking about they're multidimensional. They come from another dimension, the fifth dimension, the 11th dimension or whatever. And so the aliens story has seemed to change over the years, which indicates that, as I think, they may be etheric beings who are just talking to us at whatever level we're able to understand. And they can take on whatever being they want, and they really aren't from anywhere. Everything is here now. There's no time, space. As Jim Semivan said, they're ultra-terrestrials. They created us, and they talk in symbols. The idea that we may have this totally backwards as to what they are doing and where they're from. Now, Smith always called them the boys topside, and he would describe the beings, because you got to remember, this is before Nancy Tremaine, the first abduction thing with the Greys, that they were seen as human-type beings. In the 50s, they were all looked like us. They were Caucasian humans, good-looking guys, good-looking women, and Wilbur Smith was exactly the same. I think at one point Wilbur said, they could pass on the street. I would know who they are, but they could pass on the street. People would not know who they are, which it would indicate it's not a Grey. And I asked his son, because his son James said that at the end of his life, he had talked to his father and confronted him about this story that had been going around, that he had seen a craft outside of Washington, D.C. And Wilbur was dying at that time and said, okay, they can't do anything to me anymore. And he confirmed, yes, he had seen the craft and he had been shown the bodies. And so the son asked, I asked the son, were they grazed? He said, no, they weren't grazed. As far as he was concerned, his impression from what his father was telling him, they were human beings, but they were smaller than we were. So you have this deal where Alpha is this human-type alien, and that's according to Smith, and I'll get into the U.S. part. He gets a lot of stuff from Alpha. He's doing radio communication. This Ernie Epp guy was in my father's office, told me about the story where they were doing this communication with Alpha, where he said, I went to Shirley's Bay. Now, Wilbur Smith ran, according to Art Bridge, ran what was called Radio Ottawa, which was basically the NSA of Canada. They were picking off Russian communications, and Wilbur was the top radio engineer, so he had control of all the radio frequencies for everybody, for intelligence, for FM, AM. He was negotiating with the U.S. for frequencies and stuff like that. And so what happened was that they were getting these messages, and Wilbur wanted to use the station, what was called Shirley's Bay, which is where all the antennas were. Ernie Epp said he went there on a Sunday afternoon. He said, there's all these cars in the parking lot. He said, what's going on? He said, nobody should be working today. And he went in, and there was all these people gathered around, and the head radio guy there was arguing with Wilbur. And Wilbur was saying, make the communication. And he said, no, it's an illegal communication. I will not make the communication. Wilbur says, make the communication. And this battle went on. And the impression was that they were sending a communication to Alpha. And this guy said, it's an illegal communication. I'm not making it. And as far as Ernie Epp knew, there was no communication made, at least on that day. So you have this thing where Alpha was constantly, always talked about, always there. And Wilbur was making these interactions. And Wilbur had created, a lot of his inventions were for radio equipment that was used in Department of Transport planes. So he had these radios, and he'd been given by Alpha different patterns to build these radios that they were using to make communication. He had the telex operator, I always talk about that. Now, this is about Francis Swan meets Alpha. It starts the day before Halloween in 1953. Francis Swan tells a story that she's hanging decorations in Elliott, Maine, in the town hall for the dance the next night for Halloween. And this guy comes, it's a small little town, so everybody knows everybody. And this very good looking guy comes in and starts talking to her. And she talks to him, and then he sort of just disappears. And this is when it starts. And she maintained that was Alpha. That was the only time she ever saw him, and that he was very handsome. She was in love with him. She just thought he was great. But he was this human-type being who had come in the night before Halloween. And what happens is she starts, like, happens with a lot of these channeling situations where what happens is she gets a tone in her ear. And I can't remember if it was a right or left ear. I think it was the left ear, which would be right brain. She gets this tone in her left ear, which means that Alpha and Ponar want to send signals. And then she would write down with automatic writing, she would write down what she was being told. And then she got upset. She said, you got to leave me alone. I can't keep taking messages all the time, and stop that stupid tone in my ear. I can't stand that tone in my ear. And she ended up being able to do messaging without the tone, without the automatic writing. She could just get this. Now, this is a pattern which you've seen in other channelers. One is Jane Roberts, who challenged Seth. That one started on a Ouija board, where she describes where they're making this communication, and this person comes across on the Ouija board, and then as they go along, she suddenly realizes she knows what the Ouija board's going to actually say before it actually does it. And that's where she gets to a point where she says, you don't need the Ouija board. I know exactly what's going to happen. And she's able to actually direct channel without the Ouija board. The Ouija board is like a prop, and the prop disappears. The same thing happened in Mission Rama. You know the story of Mission Rama with Sixto and Charles Paz Wells? They had this encounter in 1974 where they were doing automatic writing, and they suddenly, this alien comes across, and says, I'm an alien. And they said, how do you know you're an alien? And they said, well, go to the desert and we'll appear, and this whole encounter starts. Now, later on, they're able to do it without the Ouija board. They can actually, they don't, or without the automatic writing. So you have this idea where somebody starts with a prop, and then as they get going along, they suddenly are able to do it without the prop. Now, Swan is getting this material starting in 1953, and Admiral Knowles, who's the Navy guy, is actually her neighbor, and she tells him, and him and his wife start to transpose what Frances Swan is getting, and they start asking these highly technical questions that she's able to answer, and I believe she only had grade 3 or grade 4 education, and she was able to answer all these technical scientific questions. And of course, then Admiral Knowles gets very interesting, so he actually contacts, and if you've seen, I posted this on my on Facebook, which got a lot of replies. He actually contacts Espy, who was the head of Naval Intelligence, in 1954, and said, I've got this woman here, and she's doing this contact, and you need to take this seriously. She's answering questions she should not be able to answer. And so he gets this whole thing. And then what happens, and this I posted on my Facebook, there's an actual, some of the stuff that was being transposed by Admiral Knowles and his wife, and the Navy intelligence actually goes up to see her. So on June the 8th, there's a transcript, and I will somehow get this into a small ebook, all the channelings that were done starting in June of 1954, two Navy representatives of Navy intelligence, Captain Bromley, U.S. Navy, and Captain Balsazi, U.S. Navy, go up. They fly up to Elliott, Maine, and they start to talk to AFA. And Admiral Knowles, I just read a little bit of it here. Admiral Knowles is talking about a landing. Now, this is the stuff that Eric Davis provided for me, and this was there's probably 70 pages of this material. So Admiral Knowles asked the question. These other Navy guys are in there, and they're all asking questions. And Frances Swan is doing this channeling thing with AFA. You speak about landing en masse in force. What do you mean? We mean to take the entire field. That's AFA's answer. How many ships and men would be involved? AFA answers, that would be up to you people. We would bring about 5,000. Yes, more if you desire. Does that mean men or bells? Now, at that time, they called the flying saucers bells. AFA answers, no, that means our bells. Some of our bells carry 3 or 4 people. Some of them carry only 1. How large a landing would be necessary for the total, all the bells given? You name your field, and we will plan likewise in accordance to the number involved. Now, you got to remember, this is exactly the same year that they opened Suffield. 1954, they were going to land AFA at Suffield. And now you see, in the United States, Navy intelligence is going to land AFA. So the Navy intelligence says, are you familiar with the Brunswick Navy landing field and the so-called Stanford Airport? AFA says, we can find these if you give us the locations on one of your maps. Then Admiral Knowles says, the Stanford field is about 20 miles east north of this location. And AFA says, I believe that I have passed over this before. And this goes on and on. This is only the first page. Actually, Knowles, make one more point here. Knowles' reply says, I've been talking with members of Navy Intelligence Service. We've had a lengthy conference, and these representatives have taken a realistic view and doubt strenuously whether there is anything tangible enough for our higher authorities to make plans to meet with you. So you can see that they're making these plans to land, the same as you have the plans for AFA to land at Suffield. And the other thing that happened in 1954, February the 20th, was the famous Eisenhower encounter at Edwards Air Force Base, where everybody's twisted the story and said it was Gray's. The original story that leaked out 2 weeks after the event said that Eisenhower had met with etheric beings. So here again, you have 1954, all these different events of encounters where they're trying to land these crafts. Now, there's another document which I will put, it's in the, it, a lot of this stuff will be in the Canadian book. We're going to reproduce a document, an FBI document. So the FBI was involved, and there was a document heavily censored, but you can actually tell what's going on, where Wilbur Smith is down there. And this is, this would be July of 1954. And he's asking Francis Swan to tell Alpha to fly over the observatory. And it looks like the agreement has been made, and the flyover is going to take place on August the 1st, 1954. Well, the flyover actually occurred on August the 8th, 1954, because Ernie Epp was there, and he told me what happened. Now, it's exactly a week later, so I don't know whether there was a change in the plans or what happened. He said that they were at this station. It was a little tiny room with all these different detectors or whatever. And he said the alarm, they had these alarms set so that they would know when something was going off. And he said that the pens on the paper were going right off the chart, like right off. It was just like something massive was going over top of the thing. Everything, all the detectors went off. And they ran outside to see what it was. It was overcast, so they couldn't tell what had flown over, but they had determined there was no way there was a plane, because they could tell when a plane flew over because it would make a certain pattern on the paper. And Ernie maintained that this was nothing they'd ever seen before. It was absolutely off the chart. Everything was going off the chart. And so Wilbur had gone public with this, and because Wilbur was a very high-level official, and everybody knew he was into UFOs, and every time he would talk about UFOs, it would be on the front page of every newspaper in Canada. People wanted to quote him. He stated that in one point, if there's nothing wrong with the equipment, we've just detected the first flying saucer over Canada's capital. And that didn't go over well with the Department of Transport. On August the 10th, 2 days later, the Department of Transport shut down the flying saucer program, said nothing to see here, we didn't discover anything. Wilbur's no longer allowed to make statements on behalf of the Canadian government. He can use our equipment, but there's nothing happening. There are no UFOs. And it was just an embarrassment. Even Wilbur said that. It was an embarrassment to the government. It was the publicity that killed it. And he was allowed to work on his own, but he was never allowed to speak on behalf of the Canadians or do anything. And that was based, if you see this FBI document, it looks very much like that was planned in the United States. A week before, it was supposed to be a week before, where Alpha was going to fly over. The other thing that's talked about, and you'll see in the Canadian book when we put the book out, is this thing with the 1954 satellites, which is a story that a lot of people really don't know about. It is one of the best stories in ufology. It was talked an awful lot. It was in Aviation Week picked it up. New York Times picked it up. All sorts of people are picking this up, and this was, according to the way I understand the story, is when everybody got the V-2 rockets from the Germans, everybody was doing these tests. The Russians got some, the Americans got some, and of course everybody was working on rocket technology, and of course it was well known that sooner or later somebody's going to put a bomb on the end of the rocket and launch it. So the U.S. Air Force had developed this long-range over-the-horizon radar type stuff to try to pick up if the Russians had developed the technology to put something on the end of a rocket and launch it over. So in 1954, this long-range radar picked up these two objects, huge objects that were orbiting the Earth. And Wilbur talked about it. Wilbur actually talked about it in an audio that I will release. And he was asking a lot of people, look in a certain direction. They knew where it was. Francis Swan, at that time, was talking about Alpha and Ponar. And she claimed that these were Alpha and Ponar's ships, and that they were huge. They were, I can't remember, 100 miles across or some huge thing, and that the U.S. government had actually admitted that these things were there, that these objects were there, but that they were natural satellites. Well, of course, we now know they're not natural satellites, because if they were natural satellites, they would still be there. They would still be orbiting. And, of course, there's nothing there anymore. But this was a story that is mentioned in a lot of the stuff, and we actually do a chapter on this. Admiral Keyhoe talks about this. This was a big story in 1954, and then it just sort of faded off the chart. So these two Navy intelligence officers had gone to Francis Swans in 1954, and they've been taught. These first guys hadn't been taught. So then this thing keeps going, and in 1959, Navy intelligence again sends two officers to Francis Swan to check up, and they said they wanted to get airtime for their tickets or whatever. But they go there, and it's at that point where they're sitting there watching Francis Swan do this channeling with Alpha. And then Francis Swan says to the one guy, I think his name was Neesham, why don't I just teach you to do it? And he said, you could do that? And she said, yeah, sit down. And she put her hand on his right shoulder, and suddenly this guy starts channeling Alpha, the same alien. So this same guy, and his name, there's two of them. I've got their names somewhere, but Neesham was one. I can't remember. But one of the guys was connected to the CIA. And I've already mentioned the Navy guy, which is Arthur Lundahl, who ran the National Photographic Interpretation Center. He was the first guy who ran the weird desk of the CIA. He was the UFO guy that claimed that he'd briefed presidents on UFOs. He was involved in a major study, which I've talked about in a previous podcast, with an eyes-only study for President Johnson that was done in 1967. It was a 9-month study done by 8 high-level guys, including Arthur Lundahl. And so Arthur Lundahl was running the National Photographic Interpretation Center, very interested in UFOs. And so these two Navy guys go back, and the one guy's connected to the National Photographic Interpretation Center. He goes to Arthur, and he says to Arthur, hey, this is the real deal. She taught me how to channel this alien. So Arthur Lundahl says, okay, sit down. Let's talk to the alien. So the guy sits down. This is July of 1954, and this is in a documentary called People Sort of Are Claiming. I put the document up, and people say, well, how do you know the document's real? Well, it's actually, the story is told in the documentary called UFOs It Has Begun. You will see in there, the story is told by Robert Friend on camera in the building, in the room where it actually happened. The Navy intelligence guy comes back from Francis Swan. He sits down in the chair. And Arthur Lundahl is running the meeting, and he said, okay, answer this. It gives all these questions. Do you favor a certain religion? Is it going to be a third world war? Asking all these questions. And this Navy intelligence guy is doing this automatic writing thing. He's, you know, replying to all these sort of things. And then at one point during the interview, Arthur Lundahl says, well, we'd like proof. And then the guy goes from automatic writing to actual voice. And he said, what do you want? And Lundahl said, we'd like you to show yourself. And Alpha said, when? Lundahl says, right now. Alpha says, go to the window. This is told by you can look it on the documentary. Robert Friend tells the story. And they go to the window, and Robert Friend in the documentary is standing there looking out the window, and a flying saucer flies by during the day over top of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Now, when that first meeting took place, Robert Friend was running Blue Book at the time. There was an emergency meeting held. Arthur Lundahl contacted Robert Friend, and Robert Friend is told to immediately go to Washington, D.C. He goes there 2 days later, I think it's July the 9th. They have a special meeting, and in the book, the Canadian book, we will reproduce the first 3 pages of that document that was written. It was a handwritten memo that was made by Robert Friend to describe the guys who were in the building, all these CIA people who were in the building, in the meeting with him. There was CIA, Office of Navy Intelligence, CIA, 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 ATIC, that was Robert Friend. So these were the people in the meeting, and they had this discussion about what had happened 2 days before. They bring in the guy who's doing the channeling, the Navy intelligence guy, sit him back down again, and say to him, okay, we want you to talk, and Alpha starts talking, and they go, and they say, we'd like you to show yourself, and Alpha said, the time isn't right. And that ends it.
Robert Friend goes back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He talks to his commanding general, and he said, this was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. The guy's Adam's apple was moving up and down. There was no doubt that we were talking to somebody, and we need to do an investigation. And the general said to him, there is an agency handling it, hands off, which would indicate that the CIA is dealing with this. Leave it alone. We're not getting involved. And that's where that story sort of ends. But again, there you have AFA doing this thing. Now, the last thing I'll read is I'll read a letter I got from Betty Hill about her interaction with Francis Swan. This is written to me in 1988. Betty Hill says, this is in response to your recent letter. Thanks for sending me a copy of the report from the director of the FBI to our Air Force base in 1954. Our base was still being built on that date, and only a small group of personnel was stationed there. Mrs. Swan saw blonde ones, the cult of AFA. I believe began in the early 1950s in California. They published a newsletter about the Good Space Brothers, and apparently was based on the writings of George Adamski. That really isn't true, and AFA was not connected. One of his guys, Williamson, claimed to Wilbur Smith in some of the correspondence I saw that he was in contact with AFA, but AFA started with Francis Swan the day before Halloween. Had really nothing to do with George Adamski, although George Adamski had the same message about the nuclear weapons. So Francis, Betty Hill continues, the tall, blonde, blue-eyed ones from Venus, who are going to save us from ourselves. Mrs. Swan was not the only one involved with this thinking, for several were claiming to receive automatic writings from AFA. Some had pictures painted of what they believed he looked like. He appeared to them and gave them personal advice on their own lives. As for the gray ones, no one had heard of these until the publicity about our capture became known in 1965. Since that time, people have reported that they were captured by those with different skin colors, white, grays, black, brown, green, pink, red. Since Admiral Knowles was on the board of directors of NICAP, he came in contact with a wide variety of people. I remember one man who claimed he was driving on the main turnpike when a UFO came down, grabbed him in his car, and took him to the circle, to circle the moon, where he saw all the beautiful cities there. I've often wondered their personal opinion of these reports, for they never went beyond saying how interesting. I never heard either one of them say they believed these reports. Did they believe our capture? And they made the arrangements for the first time we appeared in public. I know the idea of abductions was not accepted by NICAP, and Admiral Knowles was very angry about this. I was not aware that Linda Howe met with OSI at Kirkland Air Force Base. I'll leave that out. I do not accept the concept of good, evil ones. Recently, I have read some really weird reports, such as our government made a pact with UFOs. If UFOs would give them high technology information, they would permit them to capture and kill our citizens. I believe they are a form of mankind more advanced from us, but since they are man, they have the capability for both good and evil, as we do. However, I have found that they are evil only when they need self-protection. Now, I'll end with this last little part here. I'll skip some of it, but as for automatic writing, I believe that this exists, but it is extremely limited. For example, I know a young woman with a second degree education who gets an urge to write. She writes medieval French, which can be translated and is correct as in spelling and punctuation. She can barely write English. She has done this several times. This I believe. If something of value is produced, I believe. But I have seen too many talk about light and love and peace and space brothers. No value. If UFOs can communicate in this way, why not give us something, some startling information, something that can be proved? Which I guess you could also ask about the alien she was dealing with. I have no idea what happened to the Admiral Knowles files. I know after his death, Mrs. Knowles told me that she was cleaning out some of his things and gave his library, gave me his library of UFO books. The commander of the U.S. Navy, who was a close friend of Admiral Knowles, was Commander Tom Dara. Apparently, they served together during World War II. So that was another guy that Wilbur dealt with. And the other thing I should mention here, just for interest's sake, is that one of the key pieces that Wilbur handled was the 1952 piece that was claimed that was shot off of a little 2-foot orb flying saucer. I formally believe that it was, that they dropped it. It wasn't shot off by anybody. But this 1952 piece over the, when the overflight took over Washington in July of 1952, that piece was sent to Canada. And we know that Admiral Knowles sent it. And we have it in the book because Admiral Knowles actually draws the piece and he draws what it looked like. The Canadians analyzed it. Wilbur gave an analysis of what that piece showed and went back. And Jacques Vallée talks about it and seemed to hint that it ended up at the Battelle Institute outside of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Here's the final thing, and I'll end with this, which is kind of interesting, coming from Betty Hill, 1988. I suspect that some of this talk, and this is interesting because this applies to what's going on right now in Washington, D.C. I suspect that some of this talk about good, evil ones is to frighten the people into supporting Reagan's Star Wars program. Phil Klass, our notorious UFO debunker, is claiming in his latest book, if these abductions are true, then we must have this program to fight off UFOs. Our American way of thinking, if you don't understand it, then kill it. So that's from Betty Hill. The whole AFA thing is a fascinating story. I had one last guy who contacted me. He was connected to Peace Air Force Base, and he claimed that he had contact and that AFA was off the coast in the water. And I only had one communication with the guy, and very interesting. AFA sort of disappeared from the scene, but there was a lot of people in contact with this being in the 1950s, and it's an extremely interesting story. Heavily connected to the U.S. Navy and to U.S. Navy intelligence. So now U.S. Navy intelligence is playing stupid. Let me tell you, they were big time involved in 1954. Thank you for listening.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.